And welcome into the show. I'm your host, Soli. And once again, I got a new guest, Noel Vera. He's a big film buff. Welcome.
How are you doing?
I'm doing swell. How about yourself?
Great. I think we're talking about a Spike Lee joint.
We are talking about a Spike Lee joint, yeah. We are talking about the Russell Horowitz scripted Spike Lee joint that is Inside Man and briefly on its direct-to-video sequel. First off, what kind of crime mystery movies are you often into? Were you already kind of a big heist movie guy?
I know a few heist movies. I know some of the older ones. Classic Hollywood.
Like Asphalt Jungle and Usual Suspects, yeah. Even.
Sure. What do you call that? I think arguably, if you want to go back, heist movies went back to the time of Thomas Edison.
The great
train robbery. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Thomas Edison, I think it's Porter who directed it. I could be wrong on that.
Maybe. Essentially we're.
Yeah.
But all together, were you already a big fan of the filmmaker's work, Spike's?
Yeah, I'm familiar with his work. I think he's one of the better top-ranked African-American filmmakers out there. You might not call this, how do you say this?
Heist.
It's not, it's a heist movie. It's a very genre movie. Mm-hmm. Thing is, it's not one of his overtly politicized movies that wear its ethnicity on its sleeve, shall we say?
It mainly gets into just kind of just bankers and just what's going on behind the curtain there and just the New York, the NYPD, as well as, we'll probably spoil partial things. We don't want to give it all away, but it's also just kind of criminals who become giant corporations. It's a little bit of that, how the police, they imply that there's some corruption in the New York Police Department. As well as just how heavy-handed they are with how the captain, Darius, played by William Dafoe, is very heavy-handed. He can't discern the hostages from the actual gunmen. You know, they're not very careful. The main detective, Frazier, is an unusual role for Denzel Washington because usually he's, pretty hip, suave, or really evil. And here, he's kind of more laid back. He's a listener. He's diving into it and actually trying to kind of observe and see what he's saying. And they give him a lot of amusing, colorful dialogue as a negotiator.
The cast is a little diversified. There's Denzel, mm-hmm. Of course, he's the protagonist. You got a few Brits, Clive Owens, Christopher Plummer. In key roles, and I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce this right, Chiwetel Ejiofor, as one of the detectives, but I think he was more of a small role, if I remember right.
I think so, but it is an unusual role for Jodie Foster as basically the main power broker.
Yes,
basically the fixer.
She was a very powerful figure. The fact that it's a woman and they don't make a big deal about it. So, it's diversified, but it's not where your identity on your sleeve kind of diversified. It's, you might say that Spike Lee was doing it for money, but
yeah.
He turned it to a very competent job. I think the direction was terrific.
Oh, totally. And it's interesting looking at some of the, big powers that contributed to the script. You got Minho Mayhaze, a Dutch screenwriter who had worked with Denzel on The Siege and Ricochet, as well as other blockbusters like Lionheart and Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade.
Yeah, I saw his name there. It's probably one of the earliest I've noticed the name.
Yeah, he was involved when Russell Crowe, not Russell Crowe, Ron Howard was attached, and then Terry George, who's best known for a lot of his Irish movies like In the Name of the Father, as well as working on Hotel Rwanda and The Boxer with Daniel Day-Lewis. He incorporated the whole Nazi Germany and Diamond Ring elements, and it's interesting how Spike Lee has a lot of frames and bit part actors who are basically just in movie references to Dog Day Afternoon, which is interesting because you're kind of not looking for it unless you're a huge film buff. But it's so wild how midway through he didn't realize how similar the ending was to one of the plot twists in Die Hard with a Vengeance, the third Die Hard movie.
Yeah, I saw that one. I didn't notice before until you pointed it out, but yeah, there's similarities with the plot twists.
Totally. It's got an interesting Bollywood song that kind of opens it up, that kind of gets you in the mood, and Clive Owen is very relentless, but at the same time, he's really good at just kind of making you wonder what is his real dilemma. It says a lot, because Clive has kind of been wasted in just so many blockbusters or misfires where you're like, you know, this dude needs to fire his agent. He actually gets some big material to kind of chew.
Wasn't he up and running for James Bond at one point before?
I think they did talk about that. And
Daniel Craig, right?
Yeah. I thought he would have been good. He
would have been very good.
Yeah, it's just... I think he just got caught up in just a bunch of other things.
he was very good in Sin City, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a dope movie. And it's kind of a shame that altogether he's just kind of... They kind of get him or Gerard Butler, but they'd rather go for someone like a Jason Statham or other aging British actor. And I feel like he's able to do his own part here, and he's the kind of English actor where his accent doesn't stand out, and he's not really pulling a Hans Gruber or Alan Rickman, you know?
No, he's not.
He's always kind of like Benedict Cumberbatch, where he's the kind of English, doesn't really just stand out as much. Although Cumberbatch, he does kind of do that in certain roles where you're like, yes, you're clearly an English actor.
Yeah, he can act is the thing. Not like, well, Statham can act, but he's kind of
he's a genre actor versus a everyday actor.
Yeah, Owen's more of a more versatile kind of thing. I'd say that another interesting thing is the script has a lot of twists and turns. It's tightly plotted. I mean, the whole Clive Owen's whole thing, this whole a heist plot is pretty intricate, and Spike Lee goes through, you know, goes along with it, keeps the plotting clear, even the misdirections. He doesn't call attention to it until you think about it afterwards, like you look back and, oh, okay, that's what happened, so on and so forth. So that's interesting too. And maybe the most interesting thing is how well Clive Owens and Denzel play together. There's so much chemistry between them, and the two never meet.
Yeah, it's not about a final showdown. It wouldn't happen that way in real life.
No. What do you call this? It's telecommunication world. Yeah, cat and mouse. There's a cat and mouse element there. But at the same time, Denzel keeps up with Clive Owens. Clive Owens has all the cards, and Denzel manages to hold his own. I mean, he may be a half a step behind, but he's fast in the uptake.
Oh, totally. And I'll be honest, I didn't care for this movie when I first saw it, but I was in a very bad mood. I was like in the worst possible mood. And I think I was just paying attention to all the shocking, you know, usual bank threats and endless language, but it's still, with the right mature mind, you can actually get into this movie, I think. And like you say, it is way more accessible than some of Spike's movies, where they're kind of like David Lynch or even Oliver Stone. They're kind of a rant, but they're an organized rant, but they're not meant to necessarily have a conclusion. They're just kind of supposed to just show one side of society's wrongdoings. And to your point, it is, yeah, it is interesting how it's never about meeting the villain face to face. It's all kind of, but it'll appeal to us people who want to easygoing, you know, clever thriller, but it's also going to appeal to, yeah, those who want to just show kind of flaws in society, as well as an unusual heist and why everyone's even, you know, in the middle of this, how this police unit isn't prepared for this. And, you know, there's just devils in the details, but even then, it's an atypical kind of devil in the details. And it, like you say, it, I like how they even envision how the heist, like, diffusion is going to go, like how the SWAT team is going to come in and start shooting everyone up, and there's going to be a lot of casualties, and they're not going to get any answers. And it's interesting in that it goes so quick, and you're like, whoa, what's going on here?
Yeah, what's the, it's over 2 hours, 129 minutes. I just checked.
It goes by like no tomorrow. And the hostages do get some decent screen time, and I like how after the fact they're reluctant to answer what how it actually went down, because they're like, well, half of us got mistreated, or, you know, beanbagged, you know, we got
by the police,
pellet guns. And,
yeah.
Did you ever see the direct video sequel?
No, I have not. What's it like?
It had professional looking. Like a usual Universal movie, they do a lot of direct-to-TV or video sequels to all their movies. And unfortunately, despite having Reese Seaborn, who, you know, is Kim Wexler from, you know, Better Call Saul, it needed some serious just kind of rewrites. It was one of those where it was supposed to be theatrical, and they were supposed to have Denzel come back and, like, go after another criminal mastermind. Or even show what Dalton Russell did with, like, the next part of his plot. But and Jodie Foster was supposed to even return, and they just said no. It just went on for, like, way too many years. And in all fairness, I think the screenwriter kind of got blacklisted, because he, you know, he tried to follow it up with some other movies, and he had a script that got massively rewritten called Righteous Kill, which was that flop starring, you know, Robert De Niro and Al Pacino.
Oh, wow.
And 50 Cent. And it just, he kind of has faded. I don't know if he said after the fact that script was garbage. They picked a bad director. They did some rewrites. And it seems like he's now kind of back to square one, where he has to try and come up with a new script for investors and studios. And it's kind of a shame, because you like to think that hardworking people who make very ingenious scripts can keep having a thriving career, and it just seems like he's just faded into obscurity, which sucks, because you like to help out the little guy, and you also like to help out the guys who have, you know, gotten natural acclaim and success. And this is a crazy cutthroat industry, but
that's harsh. He, two major feature films,
right? One good, one not so good. And
yeah,
you would think, and unfortunately, there's nothing you can do. People think, oh, well, what I see on screen, that person's credited, they must have written it all, and they don't know how crazy the industry can be, where, you know, a director can goof off, or producers can come in and cut some footage that they don't care for. That's not, you know, it's so hard also as a creative, when you want to make a movie that you would want to see, and then make it to where an audience would want to see it.
I always wondered about the title Inside Man. I mean, Clive Owens inside, or they're referring to Denzel Washington as being Clive Owen's inside man, because in a way, in many ways, Denzel was his collaborator. Maybe unintended, didn't mean to be, but he ended up helping himself.
Yeah, it has so many different sides to it. It is not black and white. It is not, you know, anyone who thinks that was a straightforward plot, they clearly didn't watch the movie, you know, because much like Usual Suspects, you're not sure who's pulling the strings. And even then, there's like five more additional twists that pay off. And then, you know, Heat, you know, was an interesting predicament in that most people who aren't fans of it just consider it two famous stars facing off, when in reality, it's just kind of an examination of two people who are essentially the same person on opposite ends of the law. And I mean, it made sense that Brian Grazer and Universal greenlit Inside Man, because it was not only a very distinct crowd pleaser, but also just kind of a movie that was ready to showcase all, like you say, all that drama, all these different factors, all these different complex characters who, you know, aside from their imperfections and all, you know, you do forget some of the other plot twists where you're just like, whoa, there's this and that, and I wasn't ready for this. And even some of the hostages, you know, again, they get reasonable screen time and you're not sure what their dilemma is, if they're part of the heist, if they're in on it, or if they're, you know, like you say, unwilling participants.
Yeah, a lot of talking heads, but he keeps it, how do you say it? You get the sense there's a lot of voices talking.
Lots of grounding, yeah.
Yeah, and they do look at the hostages, much like in Dog Day Afternoon. I also wanted to point out that the cinematographer, and by the way, it has a great look, a kind of steel and concrete inside of a bank look, feel. I think the bank is set in downtown Wall Street. Is that right? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's and that's just it. That's where Jodie Foster's coming in, and she's like, "This is one of my, you know, top 10 banks, you know, in Manhattan."
Yeah, right.
And it's interesting how they show her and her main boss, Christopher Plummer, how they got a questionable heritage and investment in it. It's more than just a personal investment. They don't care about the hostages. They care about their money. And I like how Denzel just kind of looks at him like, yeah, you know, read me the
riot. These are people I work with. Yeah, right. These are my bosses.
Yeah. He does kind of point that out. It's like, I'm not working for the NYPD. I'm working for corporate America, and I'm not cool with that. I got people to save. And yeah.
Well, he has an uneasy, he doesn't feel comfortable with it, but he has to work with it. You know, he's
right. And he's the perfect kind of actor. Denzel apparently in an interview compared it to his role in Julius Caesar. A man with a job to do who's, you know, this is not, we already kind of get an idea from him. Like the film, you know, Spike Lee is all about, you know, feeding you stuff that anyone instantly understands what's going on. And, you know, the right people get it. In this case, it's even more clear set. You know, Denzel, we already know, is going to basically be up all night. They don't even hit home on that. It's like, we know that this is a shitty job. And someone's got to do it, and he's the guy. But like you say, it's like he instantly knows, man, I have my hands full, and I have people who are going to be very unhelpful. And he doesn't look at it as a chess game, I think you can say. He's like, I got to figure out just what he wants. Without, you know, instead of being a heavy handed negotiator or just, you know, anything else. And I like how they imply him as well, that he's an imperfect cop. He's had a scandal that he's had to deal with.
Yeah. That's what they figured is they're holding on him, right?
Yeah. He wants to get a promotion. And so I think this is kind of what he looks at it. And much like, you know, their other collaborations like Mo Better Blues and He Got Game, you know, those are good dissections of music and fame, as well as basketball and realistic, you know, redemption, you know, a father who wasn't there for his kid, who's now actually got to be a parental figure, you know, a decade way too late. And here, you know, he's basically, he's kind of trying to inspire his detective partner, Mitchell, and his plot twist with Mitchell is good. And it's just, it just shows you, again, the right people can add all these details, add all this, like you say, subtext without having to be heavy handed.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like it's kind of a rare kind of heist movie, because there's a lot of other kinds of heist movies we'll see and we're like, yeah, that didn't add up. How many times will you see a Christopher Nolan movie, half the audience buys it, the other audience is like, that's cool, but that last twist was a little too cute.
I'm not a fan of Christopher Nolan. The Inception.
Yeah, Inception's pretty wild. It's both a heist movie and a convoluted sci-fi movie.
Also a dream movie. I'm not too crazy about the dream part. It is a terrific heist movie. I do agree with you there. I think if you see it more as a heist movie,
it works a little better versus as a sci-fi movie where you're like, it's the Matrix, but you can shoot.
But if you're talking about dreams, where, you know, you go into dreams, he doesn't really treat dreams as an interesting subject. It's more like a gimmick or a gadget.
I was just about to say that. He relies too much on gimmicks, and there are times where I'm like, okay, I was down with your first 5 plot twists. Those 6 additional plot twists were just way too much.
and just, if you don't mind my going side trip, there was a similar Leonardo DiCaprio movie that involved dreams that I thought worked much better. Shutter Island, you've seen that?
I did. I really don't like the plot twist in it, but I think I do like its attempt to look like a 40s kind of picture.
Sure. The plot, I understand, yeah, it's garbage. It's the novelist I'm not too crazy about. But Scorsese, you know, without even trying very hard, gets you the sense of nightmare and dreams and reality changing shape into fantasy with, you know, a lot more fluidly and a lot more eloquently than Nolan ever does. Nolan's kind of clunky when he tries for emotional.
Yeah. My sister hates how he writes women because he's always like, Jack, help me. You know, and you're like, oh, yeah, God. No one wins in that one.
No. And like, if you're talking Nolan against Scorsese, if we're talking directing job, the scripts, okay, I guess Inception's better, but Shutter Island, you know, the way he can direct a phone book and make it interesting.
Yeah, he can show an everyday object and how, you know, nowadays everyone else seems to kind of want to just, like you say, have an object kind of just be overused as like a MacGuffin or something that will come into play later. And so it's like, well, there's no real, you know, people like Scorsese were able to show you an off-screen heist in like Goodfellas and you know, even Reservoir Dogs, you know, it's often imitated for low budget movies, but it's inspired by all those other 60s pictures, which you know, 40s and 60s pictures where you don't see the heist, but you see them talking about it afterwards. And you're just, you, the viewer, realize you can add your imagination to it without, you know, having to examine more details. And it ends at the right time where it's like, okay, I got an idea of what happened. I don't, my imagination will fill in the dots.
I got off track. I was mentioning the cinematography. It feels cold. You get a sense of how cold it is inside the bank.
It's just so cold. Yeah.
Right. It does look, it looks cold. It looks dim. That kind of dim lighting is hard to achieve, actually. You need a lot of light, paradoxically, to get that thing. I read about it in X-Files, how they made X-Files. You know, you need a lot of light to get that kind of dim look. And it's the person responsible for all that cinematography is Matthew Labatique.
Yeah, he had worked with Spike, and he enlisted his cousin to help out with the video game sequence.
Sure.
It's funny how they have an interesting moment there.
Darren Aronofsky's, right?
I think he worked with Aronofsky, yeah.
And the interesting thing is he's Filipino. He's from Filipino immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
So he's probably one of our better Filipino artists working in Hollywood. Mainstream.
Yeah, definitely a big one.
Yeah, he's a big one. He's a big name. Probably one of the best ones out there right now.
I think you're right. Because, like you say, you feel just so cold in the room and you don't even have any Foley describing the temperature of it, you know, sure. of said room.
I think my, you know, my thing is you can have cinematography that's really pretty. I mean, pretty for pretty's sake, that's fine. But cinematography that serves a point, that serves to convey a feeling.
Yeah, you know that they're trying to actually build the world instead of sidetrack. Right. And I hate to say this, had it been a blockbuster filmmaker, they probably would have been so worried about close-ups and popular music playing during montages that kind of take you out of it, because you're just like, well, I don't really know what's going on and I'm not connected to anybody because all I'm seeing is loud music played during a violent sure. shootout. You know?
Yeah, another MTV sequence, a montage.
MTV, sequence. Yeah. You know. Sure. And unfortunately, some of the best have unfortunately hired a lot of MTV guys and you're like, how did they even storyboard this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure, but I do think Spike Lee storyboards.
I'm sure he even had a shot list. It's like, we need this kind of shot to get this mm-hmm. kind of emotion, this kind of feeling, this kind of chill. Because, mm-hmm. yeah, he does frills, but there are moments where you're just like, man, I feel so dirty and crooked inside because I'm just watching all these imperfect people who they got some serious issues, you know.
Well, so you've mentioned that Dog Day Afternoon, and yeah, the parallels are obvious. I think there's another one
because yeah, he does video games also briefly, where he notes how a lot of them are kind of, you know, this was when people were complaining about violent video games versus, you know, psychopaths, and he has that brief moment in there, and you're like, it's interesting how all these other things that should be kind of be getting policed aren't being policed because people are worried about a stupid bank, you know.
Yeah. Oh, that's a nice that's probably a Spike Lee addition there.
All the trivia I was seeing, he basically added it in the middle of it. He was like, hey, here, because anyone else, like you say, would probably have a subplot and it would make you wonder what did that have to do with anything. And Spike, mm-hmm. you're so used to all these other side conversations, essentially. Sure. You know, he opens the door, like you say, and it's earned, because, you know, anyone else would probably have that in there and you'd be like, take that 20 minutes out. That didn't have anything to do with anything.
It might be in the script for original. Well, I'm not sure, but Spike definitely gave it a kind of spin or gave it its privileged moment. Sure.
Totally.
What's this? Dog Date. And there's another one with Jason Statham.
Oh, really?
The bank job.
Yeah, the bank job. That was a real life.
That's a low budget. Yeah, real life case. That would have been an interesting parallel. And kind of. The one case where Statham actually could act, I thought, wasn't much of a stretch. You know, sullen, dangerous looking British guy. But, you know, at least he looked authentic. He looked like a real character there.
Right. And they had a lot of old school kind of guys, you know, involved with it. So it didn't feel like, you know.
He was acting in a vacuum. He had support.
Yeah, he did have some support. Yeah. Well, this has been a delight having you on here. And anything you'd like to promote?
By chance. Well, I didn't write about Inside Man, but I do have a blog where you can, read my stuff. I write Business World. It's a Filipino daily. Nice. My blog is criticafterdark@blogspot.com.
Nice.
And Critic After Dark, if I may just mention it, I started out writing for film. Well, I was a banker. I was an assistant manager.
Oh, wow. So this movie kind of hits close to you.
Especially the employees, I did feel for them, but I've never been in a bank heist, thank goodness.
Yes,
happen in the Philippines quite often. They're actually more common than you think. But that's during the day, and then at night, I just change to my secret identity and start watching movies and writing about them. So that's why I'm a critic after dark.
Sweet.
It's also a play on classic Filipino film City After Dark, Ishmael Bernal. Filipino films is kind of my specialty. Heists are like a sideline, like my critic writing job. So Critic After Dark, blogspot at blogspot.com. And my latest article is about The Fablemans.
Nice. And so you're up to date on the recent blockbusters.
Sure. Autobiographical films by Ukrainian Jewish filmmakers like Steven Spielberg and James Gray. They're both Ukrainian Jewish ethnicity, which I found interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. There's still some good cinema coming out.
Okay. I don't know. What's your favorite heist movie?
Die Hard. Because you got all these things to... but altogether, it's just a very well done diabolical plan. And... unfortunately, most people just think of it as just a hostage movie, but it's also a disaster movie, as well as just showing just all these different barriers. You got unhelpful people preventing this incident from being resolved. You got, again, unlikely heroes, you know, everything from a limo driver and an off-duty cop to unhelpful, FBI guys.
Johnson, right?
Yeah. Especially Agent Johnson. Yeah.
He had good chemistry, and also he had good chemistry with Alan. Oh my gosh,
his name is Rickman.
Rickman.
But yeah, Reginald Bell Johnson, and Rickman in a star-making role. But it seems like nowadays other heist movies are too busy just stealing from each other. And I get it; it's so easy to do. But I mean, there's so many different kinds. There's Point Break. There's Swordfish. There's Ocean's 11. And now You See Me.
The Ocean's 11 was interesting because, Steven Soderbergh, you can tell he's...
Yeah, just, he had done Out of Sight, and he just did No Sudden Move. And
yeah, but this one was for fun, and he was enjoying himself.
Absolutely.
The Point Break, I haven't seen that. Catherine Bigelow, I always found her interesting.
I think
she's
a
hardcore action director. I think really she's better than her former husband.
Right. She edited and... co-scripted it with him, and I think you'd dig that one. But we'd love to have you back on the show. You mentioned some other good options we could discuss, and we're down to have you for those.
Yeah.
You enjoy your blogging in the meantime.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Anytime.
Okay.
Be safe out there.
We'll return after these messages.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out The Who Would Win Show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR. We add them to our queues. We wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the U.S. We are in the U.K. We are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan. We're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode, we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
Run all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a jacked up.